You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film.
Sand. Camels. Orents. Only my friends get to know my name, and my friends listen to Zach on Film, so my name is Zach, if you didn't catch that. And today, we're talking Lawrence of Arabia! Extend this for 3 hours.
Good luck.
Zach, Lawrence of Arabia was your homework last week, and you decided to skip class.
Well, I was still watching it.
He didn't have enough time to watch it in the week between the shows.
I sat down in one showing.
No way.
Yeah, it was great. I watched it for about an hour upstairs, and the boy, my oldest, sat down, and he watched it for a while, too. And he was kind of into it, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then he had to go to bed, and then because I didn't want all the noise,
right?
Went downstairs and finished watching the rest of it.
I can see how he got into it. I mean, it's not like...
He thought it was cool that the guy rode a motorcycle and then died.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
And then he's like, well, how come he died? He's like, well, because those people got in the way. And he's like, well, why is he there? And I was like, well, now they're telling the story of what led up to him getting on that motorcycle and crashing.
Yeah. Camels.
And he thought the camels were cool. And the,
yeah, that's cool.
And the fact that he was playing with matches and lighting his, you know, putting it out on his skin was cool.
Did he like the Super Framavision?
You know, we're not getting it in Super Framavision
here.
No. We are getting the 2000 restored edition. That's the one that we're watching. 222 minutes. That does include about 15 minutes of music at the beginning and about a 5-minute, 10-minute intermission music break.
It was like 5 and 5.
Was it 5 and 5?
Yeah,
I know it just fast-forwarded.
The music started starting. I was like, oh, there's nothing on film. This will be like 30 seconds. Yeah, I think it was about 4. And then there was an intermission.
So what is this story about?
This is...
It's about 3.5 hours long.
This is a biopic about a officer man in the British Army who becomes like the liaison between Britain and the... Arabs?
The Arab tribes.
Yeah. In their World War One, as they look to take over certain towns, Damascus being a big one at the end.
And why are they doing this?
Because they want to get rid of the Turks.
Okay, because of the big world war going on. Yeah. They're fighting the Turks in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
The British believe that if they can get T.E. Lawrence to go out and act as a liaison, that he can rally them to support and drive the Turks back. Little do they realize that Lawrence... goes out and becomes mad with power.
He goes full
and turns into a guerrilla warrior just lays waste to everyone that his army.
He goes insane.
But simultaneously becomes a champion for the rights of the people. Like, he doesn't want to turn things back over to Britain.
Right.
Like they want him to.
He wants the Arabs to take control of their stuff, and then they kind of don't want that at the end.
Well, it doesn't really work out.
Yeah.
Well, Okay, so here's the other thing that you have to realize if you're watching Lawrence of Arabia, is this is based on an actual person,
right?
And based on some actual events, although things have been modified to fit the story. Names have been changed, characters have been changed, new characters have been added, historical figures have been dropped. The thing about, you know, just turning control over Damascus back over to the British within a couple of days is not quite right. I think it was like 2 or 3 years before full control was. And again, it's not turning it over because you are our conquerors, but it's because they didn't want to deal with the bureaucracy,
right?
Is what's going on there. So, you know, there's a lot of controversy around this film from Lawrence historians. When this movie was first released, the T.E. Lawrence historians were just like, or the biographers were just like, this is not right. This is misleading. This part isn't right. This is incorrect. This movie is terrible. Now there are elements in the movie that current day biographers look at and say, yes, that is very close to what really happened. And this movie is based on newspaper reports, Lawrence's own journal, and then I forget the third aspect, just probably historical record, is where they cobbled this together. Directed by David Lean, one of the great directors. This movie fits into the epic category, the epic genre of movie. And we talked about that a few weeks ago when we were doing Mad, 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 Mad World. In the fact that we're in that time period where we're trying to compete with television, we want to do something that is not your square screen, not your widescreen, but something that's filmed in, I think it was Panavision 65 or Pana 65 or Pana 70. Yeah. I forget exactly which. Zach, you probably know this.
I know I was reading about the restoration to get to the Blu-ray, and they were doing the restoration off of an 8K print.
Yeah, yeah.
A film. So,
so it's a pretty big.
That's rather large. That's like double what we would. I mean, if you're going to shoot a movie, I think film's 2K, right?
Film is 2K. You've got 4K Ultra HD, which will be coming out.
Right.
And so, this is even bigger than that.
A very large film.
And so even when we are watching this today, we're still getting a little bit of this scene being cut off. A little bit of these shots being cut off.
Yeah.
Actually, a little bit more than a little bit in my TV. I actually had to go in and change my thing on my television when I was playing it back.
You had to set it to widescreen?
I had to set it to like super giant glow in the dark widescreen. I actually, you know, I basically projected it on the wall. No, that's not true. But I did have to adjust to the widescreen to see edges. And even then there was, you know, some choppy, I think. What was the Panavision aspect ratio?
That's what I was looking for.
Was it like 22:9 or something? It was something ridiculous.
That sounds.
It
really
was.
Right.
Here it is. 2.2:1.
Oh, my word.
So you're looking at a movie that is almost 2.5 times wide as it is tall.
Right.
Known as, well, in this case, the Panavision one. Right. And I'm trying to find the exact one here, but I'm pretty sure it's 2.2:1.
Yeah. Just hugely, hugely weird. But I will say this, and one of the most fascinating parts of this film is seeing the life of Obi-Wan in between when he left the Jedi Order and, of course, his battles there on Tatooine,
you know,
before Luke Skywalker arrived.
And interestingly, if you want to tie this back into Star Wars, some of these locations were actually used later in Star Wars. And
Lawrence of Arabia actually shot on Tatooine.
And it was also... It was
cheaper then.
Oh, I forget where it was.
Jordan
in the
Morocco.
First Phantom Menace movie, they used some locations that were in Lawrence of Arabia. In Jordan. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jordan. I was thinking for some reason Tunisia, but I may be thinking of...
Well, a lot of Star Wars was shot in Tunisia. Lawrence of Arabia was mostly shot in Jordan and in Spain. In fact, the whole attack on Aqaba is was shot in a dried up riverbed in Spain. But most of the rest was all shot in Jordan. The Jordanian government and the king were really helpful in finding all the locations. The only times that they got into a little bit of trouble was when they found out that, and this is from a scene that is not in the restored version, but I guess was in the original 222-minute release. They were reading from the Quran, and they got a little freaked out because they were like, there shouldn't be a Westerner who's reading the Quran, and we have to make sure that there's an interpreter on set during those scenes to make sure that everything is said exactly correctly. Yeah. So as not to offend.
He didn't know any Arabic or anything.
Right.
So they wanted to make sure it's
And Lawrence did. Peter O'Toole didn't.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that's the other thing that's not really spelled out in the movie is that Lawrence was very fluent in a number of different languages. He had actually been in Jordan, Syria as a covert spy as World War I was gearing up. So he knew the layout of the land, which if they would have included that in the movie, people would have had a better understanding of why they took this cartographer and shipped him to the Middle East because or shipped him out into the desert, because here he is in Cairo just making maps and spouting his silly nonsense and lighting matches onto his skin. And then they're like, Lawrence, we want you to go to the middle of nowhere and meet up with this tribe and get a read on King Fasil or Fasil, which is played. Which is played by Obi-Wan Kenobi,
Alec Guinness,
which is in itself a little weird to see Alec Guinness in brownface to an extent.
Yeah, I mean, there's three major Arabic characters that you meet. One of them is actually played by an Arab. One of them is played by a British man. One of them is played, I believe, by a Mexican.
Yes,
Anthony Quinn.
Yep.
Yeah.
Perhaps Mexican American. I don't remember exactly what his.
I don't remember if he was. I know that he is of Mexican descent. I don't know if he is literally born in Mexico.
But everyone else, they're fine grabbing some Arab actors, and some of the faces are familiar. If you pay close attention,
your Omar Sharif is in there.
Yeah. But everyone else, you're right. Nobody of Arabic origin in this movie. One thing I will say that I think is really cool, and if we could go back in time, Peter O'Toole, in like the very first shot you see him in the desert where he's got his skin is just starting to turn tan and his hair is brilliant gold and his eyes are like, you know, sea blue. I mean, super blue. Man, you look at that and that's Doc Savage. That's like that is the Lester Dent version of Doc Savage as he originally appeared in the pulps. And I'm like, holy crap, he would have been a perfect Doc Savage.
And I think that, you know, taking out the parts that made him really qualified kind of helped the character arc that they wanted to tell, which is this unassuming young man who goes into this strange world and blossoms into something entirely different. Maybe even goes native. It's up for debate, even in the
I think in the way that the film and Zach, what do we, you know, fill us in here. Do you think that Lawrence went native in his time with the tribes?
I mean, there's definitely extent of him. Like, it seemed like he almost wanted to become an Arab at times.
I mean, he's just, you can tell he's obviously fascinated.
He's very in, I think, sympathetic and wants to see them thrive.
Yeah.
And is certainly willing to do a whole lot to make them a strong people.
Well, I mean, you just see the moment where they bestow upon him their garb.
Right.
And he just wants to ride out and see how it flutters in the wind. And then he gets around the bend where they can't see him. And he's just tickled pink over the fact that, look at me, I am, what's the silent film?
D.W. Griffith.
No, but I mean the Valentino. You know, you can tell he's almost like, I am Valentino in this silent film. Hello, madam. And he's bowing and he's doing all these great things and he's just having a fun time playing. Mm-hmm. And then he starts to really get entrenched into the culture.
He gets into that role a little too much.
Yeah, well, not just into the culture, but as like this, he becomes like he feels that he's like this unstoppable Superman.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and he gets to that part where we're going to is not only does he go in wanting to help these people, he ends up becoming the very thing that I think he doesn't want to become.
Mm-hmm.
He ends up becoming, quote unquote, the Great White Hope. Right. I mean, he basically says to the British generals, I won't have to pay them to fight. they will come for me.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And basically saying that I am their God. They do what I want them to do or what I will them to do. And then he rides out, and in that second half of the movie, he cannot find people to support his cause. And he has to pay off, you know, murderers and thieves to come and fight with his guerrilla bandits. And as the winter campaign goes on, they start to abandon him to the point where it's just he and a handful of other guerrillas fighting in the desert. And Lawrence gets captured. He gets beaten. He's probably raped is the innuendo in the movie.
Mm-hmm. It's very clearly implied.
And I think that's actually historical. They talked about that. I was reading some history stuff.
So, yeah, there's also some implications that Lawrence was a sadomasochist and a homosexual. So mm-hmm. that while he did get beaten and flogged and raped, he actually enjoyed it. Every part of that, you know, that's the implication mm-hmm. that comes out in parts in the movie, as well as some historical commentary. I'm not saying that's in biographies, but you know, the fact that he's
that
you know, he's,
part is in one of the biographies. Just a few years before the film, someone had posited in one of the biographies, you know, what we basically the sadomasochism and the possible homosexuality. So mm-hmm. that is something that they didn't necessarily make out of whole cloth. Someone else had said, this is what we think is true, or this is what we believe. And, of course, it was the 1950s, so you say it out loud, that makes it possibly true.
They certainly toned it down in this movie. I mean, you see him, you know, putting the matches out on his skin, and people are like, oh, you're crazy. And he's like, oh, no, it's not that big a deal once you get used to it. But then when you get to the flogging scene...
I'm so sunburned.
Yeah.
I'm sad.
And there's, you know, to a point I want to say that Lawrence also turns to the dark side to an extent to where he becomes not only mad with influence and power over these people, mm-hmm. but he gets sort of out of control and mad with the ability to just kill mm-hmm. viciously mm-hmm. and without remorse. You know, he makes the decision to kill this person that he saved in order to keep the tribes together. And then later he, you know, unfortunately, one of these boy companions that he's taken under his wing dies in quicksand. But then when it comes time to kill this Turkish army who's raped and pillaged a village, it's all out. Just leave no one alive. No, kill them,
well,
whatever.
I would say that definitely the killing aspect of it, he's always very reluctant.
Not towards the end.
I don't think at the end he was.
No, he's just like, there's that Turkish soldier that's wanting to give up, and Lawrence just kills him.
Well, that's because they were already in the thick of the fighting. That one guy charges off by himself.
And Lawrence
just sits there, and he's like, whatever. And then when he finally dies, then he spurs everybody on. Right. I think what's really realistic, even if it didn't actually happen,
mm-hmm.
what I think is really realistic about this movie is how many times Lawrence just totally gives up.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, he's like, oh, I had to kill my friend. I'm done.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going back to Britain. I'm going to be a baker.
Well, and sadly, he is a character that doesn't, once he gets embedded, once he gets captured by the Turks and then is released, and he says, I'm done with this. He goes back and he finds out he's a person who cannot be in either world.
Right.
He realizes that he's not of the Arabic tribes. He realizes that he can't be a British citizen anymore, because when he shows up in his uniform and he tries talking to people, they're just like, man, this guy's laying it on a bit thick, don't you think? Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy is not one of us anymore.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's very interesting.
And the cool thing about that is that the movie plays that out from the beginning. Like, even before he goes out and, you know, becomes this pseudo Arab, he already doesn't fit in.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, right. Like the very first interaction that he has with a superior, like the superior thinks that he's making fun of the salute. Right. And he's like, no, I'm sorry, sir. That's just my manner.
Mm-hmm.
Again, also a big implication that he's a homosexual, which never actually is straight up addressed in the movie.
No.
There's lots of, you know, allusions to it, certainly.
Well, and I think that that may be two things. Part of that, I think, is this was an actual historical personage, but I think it's also the fact that this was 1962. And I think in 1962, that veiled allusion, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, I think that was pretty much the way people dealt with alternative sexualities. And I think that
as opposed to today, where there wouldn't even be an allusion in the right. in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right, right. They just strip it out entirely.
Yep.
But I think that it was one of those things where definitely the filmmakers wanted to make sure that this was something that got in there, because it is very strongly implied in several places. But I think it's also one of those things where, were they under the Hays office in 62, or would they have been an MPAA?
No, I forget when MPAA started, but they certainly wouldn't have been under the Hays office.
Well,
for this film,
whatever came after the Hays office. The Lawrence office.
The question that I have for you, Zach, is the Johnston era would have been all the way to 63.
Okay.
So that would have been the MPPDA. But not the MPAA.
AA, right, yes. Which was like 69.
Right. Yeah, 66. The question that I have for you, Zach, is please draw a parallel between what you see in the, and I'll just say this, and I know people, and I don't mean it to be as bad as it sounds, but the gimmicky, you know, Super Panavision,
right,
of this movie and something of today's technologies.
Right. Well, that parallel would definitely be 3D happening at the moment.
Why do you say that?
Well, it's a form of viewing a movie that is almost solely possible inside of a movie theater. I mean, technology today is advancing where we can watch 3D at home, but
right, no,
we
but
can't. I mean, we can't watch Super Panavision.
Well, we can. I mean, you know, the home theaters. I mean, with my home theater, you guys have sat down and watched it. That's a pretty big screen, right? Yeah, I mean, it's what, that's 70, 80 inches, something like that.
But I mean, we're talking about normal circumstances there.
Right,
I mean,
right.
So yes, you can't get the big Panavision experience in the theater.
So it's essentially to a up. An artistic ploy to get people to come and watch the movie in the theater.
Right. More people are concerned about television today. Right. People are concerned with the internet and television and DVRs and all these things, the internet. And so to put in 3D is kind of that answer of let's bring them back.
Wait, into the theater. Internet?
And the internet.
Yeah, don't forget the internet.
Although you can get 3D on the internet if you've got the glasses and the YouTube channel. Yeah. So.
And if you're willing to have a tremendous headache for the rest of your natural life.
So, you know, this ultra widescreen format kind of faded away because of the size of theaters,
right?
Technology.
I'm sure the film was quite expensive.
I'm sure it was back then.
Yeah.
Do you think the same thing will happen now to 3D? Or has it become so embedded that, you know, 3D televisions and everything that we have at the home are going to help perpetuate the process of theater to home release? Let's keep pumping it out.
Following 3D has been kind of interesting, because when Avatar came out, it was kind of accepted that this is going to be around for a couple years. This is going to be a thing people are going to go to try to make Avatar money.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's lasted longer than people thought.
Certainly longer than I thought.
And really, and it's not just like weird side movies doing it. It's like Avengers. It's the biggest money-making movies. The biggest money-making movies of the year will generally go, will have a 3D theater showing.
The thing is, though, we are in it
right
now.
Right.
It's true. Another year goes by and you're like, oh, I can't believe that this thing is in there, is still there. But when you think about it, you know, if it's been around for 5-6 years, you know, how long were people creating stuff in Panavision?
Yeah, from about 55 through about 65.
Right. I mean,
the original 3D
nobody
runs like 5-6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody does stuff that's that wide anymore.
Right.
No.
Although
IMAX is pretty close.
Yeah, pretty big. But that has its own unique infrastructure.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think the reason why they go with the big blockbusters as their primary 3D is because they already know audiences are going to flock to that. And then on top of that, you're doubling the ticket price for these glasses that have feces on them, you know?
Everything has feces.
I know.
If you go through the
universe, that's why I can't sit in this fancy furniture that I bought for Zach and Rodrigo to sit in, because
we craft it every week.
Fecal matter.
If you worked where I worked, you would never worry about these things again. Trust me. Just
I have I have two kids. One of them is just now going through potty training, and I've been changing his stinky ass diapers for 2 years. So yes, I know all about.
I was a CNA at a long term care for 2.5 years.
There
so
you go. So
I was all up in the poop. It was all
deep in the poop.
I interview people at feedlots.
Are we playing one upsmanship?
The next question, Zach.
They keep me across the hall from the dead people.
The next question that I have, I'm posing to you.
Yeah, dead people.
Not dead poop.
Yeah. I deal with animal carcasses.
Steven is posing Zach a question.
Yeah, now this is a question that's redirected back at you that you had asked Matthew in a recording session that we did for Top 5, which is another one of our podcasts, which won't come out till next week.
Right.
Okay? So in next week, if people are listening to this in release order, they're going to go, wait a minute, Zach isn't smart in asking Matthew this question. He actually is.
Just wait a while. First. They're all impressed, and then I depress them. Yeah.
So let me... you depress them.
It is wonderful.
But let me ask you this. In this story, we know that Lawrence's history has been changed from what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And they make no qualms about it.
Right.
Would you rather have a movie that is historically accurate or one that takes licenses and liberties with characters and situations to make it a more interesting story?
I'm gonna
have to say historically accurate, and this is why. Because Jobs came out 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, and it's not accurate.
Exactly. And so I was kind of interested in it. I was like, I would like to see a movie about Steve Jobs. And then I read Steve Wozniak and a couple of people from Apple were like, well, it's not really that accurate. So I was like, well, I really don't want to see it then. And so...
But do you think less now of Lawrence of Arabia, knowing and doing the research that you've done afterwards, that there are inconsistencies in the story, inaccuracies in the story? Peter O'Toole is like 6'3", and Lawrence was like 5'11". There's like six inches difference.
5'4", something.
Yeah, there's like 6 or 7 inches between their height and their build and everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, does that lessen the movie for you to know that the movie that you're watching is based on actual events, names, places, and sequence have been altered for storytelling purposes?
In the case of Lawrence of Arabia, I don't think it does. And maybe it shouldn't in Jobs either. Maybe just because I respect Steve Jobs and I had an idea of who Steve Jobs was, and so I want to watch a movie about him. But I think you have to, in my mind, to adapt anything to film, into movie, or to really any medium, things are going to have to be changed and altered, and things are going to have to be cut out, and things will have to be skewed a little bit. Because you're trying to make something entertaining. And I think, I mean, they already showed, like, 45 minutes of just camels walking across a desert. I mean, I'm sure there was about 18 more days of camel footage they could have shown to make this historically accurate, but you gotta edit some stuff out. You gotta change a story.
Still, though, I mean, there's a difference between, yes, it took them 7 days to get across a desert, and, let's completely erase this character.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or really, this person, and not make them a character.
Right.
Do you have some thoughts on this, Rodrigo?
Yeah. My thought is I will take an entertaining movie.
As will I.
Because I'm going to go see a movie. The fact that it's historically accurate or historically inaccurate is only a little bit of a hook. The only issue that I have with historical inaccuracy is if it... kind of is like complicit to like oppressive ideas.
Oh, sure.
Like if it's like if what really happened was the British sent this guy who just kind of facilitated things, and it was actually like this awesome Arab general that did all of this, and then in the movie they switched it to Lawrence being the one who does it.
Right.
Well,
that would be terrible. But other than that, I would much rather see a movie about this weird, interesting, like effeminate, crazy guy and his adventures in the desert, than something where, you know, there's even more time spent negotiating with Arabic tribes and more time spent with translators and more time spent doing all of that other stuff.
So there's go ahead, Matthew.
On the subject of historical accuracy, there is one thing that problem, I guess, that comes up for me. Have you guys have seen Titanic, right?
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah. With, you know, the boat sinks.
Yeah, and I had to see it multiple times.
You know that corrupt guy who's running around with a revolver and eventually realizes what he's done and shoots himself in the head?
Is it the Phantom?
Because he's been a bastard. No.
No, he decided to try to get away.
One of the guys on the boat, one of like the stewards of the vulgar boat.
It was the...
Kate's lover.
Original lover. Now, I thought that was the Phantom.
That was the
Billy
Phantom.
Zane.
No, Billy Zane didn't die. He survived.
Okay, didn't stop. He?
Yes. This, no, he did. Yes, he survived. He did because he
He shot himself.
Wait, who shot himself in the face?
Oh! During the film.
Okay,
the guy who was like... Yes.
The prologue.
That man is a real historical personage. He is widely known to be one of the heroes of Titanic. He did not do the things that the movie posited him doing with his name and likeness. He did not kill himself out of despair for the horrible things he had done. And he still has living relatives somewhere in Wales who are like, oh my God, that was my great grandfather. That was totally, wait, what are you guys doing? That to me in historical stuff is problematic. It's one thing to say, well, these are things that T.E. Lawrence did or maybe did or might have done or things that he might have been inclined to do. But it's another thing to say, well, for our story's purposes, we needed a villain. So we're going to use this real personage in that role.
You know, one of the other things that's historically inaccurate is the Sykes-Picot, I think is the pronunciation, the agreement about what was going to happen after they took over the territory. Lawrence actually knew that way earlier in the sequence of events and still went out and fought alongside the Arabs than what's portrayed in the movie, where he only finds out about it really late in the story. So Matthew, you have a problem with the historical inaccuracies of changing the intent of a historical figure.
This is my thing is a lot,
but
of
you don't have a problem that Rose and, what's his face?
Jack
got it on inside of a Model A Ford instead of a,
well, it should be noted that the only car aboard Titanic was actually in pieces in the hold. But more importantly, Jack and Rose are...
Yeah, that's because afterwards when they find it, it was in pieces.
Shut up. Jack and Rose are not real people. Jack and Rose are made-up characters. And there's a concept that you'll see in a lot of these biopics or these historical fictures of the composite character.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who didn't exist, but someone who takes on the role, or, you know, in some cases, the role of multiple characters. And I'm really oddly sort of fine with that, because like Rodrigo said, it's about a good movie in most cases. If I really want to know about this man's history, I will, in fact, go to a textbook, or to be honest, it's 2013. I'll probably go to the wiki. But when you come down to it, if you're telling me a story, that story can't necessarily be the actual reality of someone's life, because I don't know about you guys, but my life kind of ebbs and flows, and I'll have days and days and days where I'm just completely and utterly boring. And then, you know, we'll have a show and I'm like super awesome for an hour and a half and people think, hey, he must be fun to be around. No, I'm a jackwagon. And I think that for me is kind of the description of the bio movies or the historical movies with a real historical presence. If you have to create a role for someone, I feel like you should create the character as well, if that makes sense.
Okay.
To where you're actually using bits of a person's life. They've obviously changed the order of events. They've changed some of the expectation. they've definitely changed at least our perception of what, you know, Thomas Lawrence was like before any of this happened. So I would say, yeah, I'd rather see them take liberties that are obviously taken liberties, if that makes sense.
All right, it does.
Indeed. I'd like to give a little shout out here to some people that back the Major Spoilers cause. I'll give you a little shout out real quick. Tyler Gibson, Jesse Ayers, Matthew Goyne, Zachary Radke, Kent Daw, Darring Heisenberg, Ian
That's
Hamilton,
Heisenberg.
Nara Van Rosem, Casey Box, Nicole Gross, and Matt Verlinden. Thank you so much for backing the Major Spoilers cause and keeping all that we do up and running.
And we do what we do.
Doo-doos.
And if you would like to get your name, if you'd like to have your name read, or if you'd like to be included in some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, head over to members.majorspoilers.com, our secret cabal of spoilerites. Hang out over there and get access to some other stuff. You can find out more. Members.majorspoilers.com. List of movies that were shot using Super Panavision 70. Mm-hmm. Okay? This 2.2:1 aspect ratio. The Big Fisherman from Disney in 59, Exodus in 1960, West Side Story in 61, Lawrence of Arabia in 62, The Great Escape in 63, My Fair Lady in 64, Cheyenne Autumn, which I'm not familiar with, in 64, Lord Jim in 65, The Heroes of Telemark in 65, Grand Prix presented in 70mm Cinerama in 66, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Ice Station Zebra, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang in 68.
Wow. I'm surprised at how many of these I've seen.
McKenna's Gold, Krakatoa, East of Java, Selected Scenes in Tadeo, presented in 70mm Cinerama, Song of Norway in 1970, advertised as on the Cinerama screen, Ryan's Daughter in 70, Close Encounters of the Third Kind in 77, special effect shots only, Tron in 82, live action scenes and partial CGI scenes only, Brainstorm in 83, virtual reality scenes only, and Auto Emotion in 84, a BMW promotional short subject.
I love that they put in some of those, they put in presented in
Cinerama. 70.
Yeah, Cinerama. Just like every movie is like something, 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 Piranha 3D.
21 movies. 21 movies shot using this process.
Right.
Cheyenne Autumn is John Ford's last flick. It has Richard Widmark and Ricardo Montalban and Edward G. Robinson.
Okay.
I mean, we're seeing Panavision stuff into the 80s.
Oh, sure, sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I mean, you see that there starts to be a huge drastic drop in the gap between.
As kind of you see it in the 80s as one of those moments of, hey, wouldn't it be interesting to play with these old tools?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, which really is what 3D is.
Well, look at this. Oh, no, look at this. Look at this run. 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 64, 65, 65, 66, 68, 68, 68, which seems to be the high point. 69, 69, 70, 70, 77, 82, 83, 84.
Wow.
So really by 69, that was
69,
the end.
It kind of ran.
So that was a decade of movies.
And most of those last ones were just select shots.
Right.
And you got to imagine, to a large degree, this is not just, hey, let's keep shooting in Panavision. Right. At least, like, this is what I hope, because I hope this is what's happening with 3D. It's also, we've already invested all this money in this equipment. The theaters have switched over to be able to do it. So we can't not do it anymore. And the point where the technology is finally paid for and you can justify not doing it anymore, that's when things start to decline.
So let me point out something that happened right in the middle of all this that probably is a good indicator of why Panavision, why we didn't see 50, 100, 200 movies shot in Panavision over this time period. In 1963, AMC Theater opened a two-screen Parkway Twin, in Kansas City, a concept which company president Stan Durwood later claimed to have come up with in 1962. This was the start of the multiplex.
Oh.
So if you're looking at how can we get more people to see more of these movies now that we're done with the studio system, or the studio system basically on the outs by this point, and
smaller
we can start
screens.
Smaller screens, or we're fixed in a fixed real estate, and now we have to try to figure out how to make more screens. We make the screen smaller. We can fit people into this space. We sell multiple movies at the same time. We make our money. I remember in Ottawa growing up, we had a nice theater. It was one big screen, and I went, I mean, saw Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, this is one of those theaters that have three sections to it. You know, you have a large center aisle and then two 10 to 15 seat side aisles.
Mm-hmm.
Really big. And saw Muppet movie. I mean, just saw all the movies growing up there. And then they decided to split the movie theater in two to have two screens. And this would have happened in the late 80s, early 90s. And it was just not the same going experience. Mm-hmm. But the theater was making twice the money because they now could sell two movies. So knowing this fact about the start of the multiplex happening right around the same time as Panavision was going in, I could see the multiplex killing Cinerama and Panavision movies from that standpoint.
Which is interesting compared to now with 3D when cinemas are paying lots of money to update so they can show 3D movies.
Right. Because
the price increase.
Yeah, because this time, unlike back then, the money-making strategies for both parties are in sync.
Right.
Back then, it was like, oh, let's make it more spectacular, say the studios. Oh, let's make it smaller and cheaper, say the theaters. Right. Yeah. This time, the studios came to the theaters and were like, hey, we're doing this 3D thing. You want to buy into it? The theaters were like, yeah, nobody's coming to see movies anymore.
Right.
So that's why everybody's kind of on the same page about it.
The other thing, and this goes back to the discussion about why things may have changed a little bit in the historical accuracy of the movie, is that if you think about it, the Lawrence of Arabia story follows the hero with 1,000 faces, the hero's journey, almost exactly. Here's the refusal of the call.
Yep.
Here we go and have the fight in the desert and the fleeing and you know, the returning with the boon of more knowledge of what's gained. I mean,
Magical journey.
The magical flight magical is journey. In there in a couple of places. But I find that interesting that, and I guess you could read any story into this because that's not necessarily.
What
Campbell was trying to say is that there are so many stories that unintentionally
tie
into this theory of the same story narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You could probably apply it to a lot, but as I was watching Lawrence of Arabia, and again, this was a couple of weeks ago, I was struck by, oh, wait a minute. Here's the part in the story where the hero does this. Here's the part of the story where the hero does this. And so, to a large extent of that movie, it follows Hero's Journey very well. Are you familiar with Hero's Journey?
Yeah.
Okay.
You did a nice long lecture on it.
Yep.
In college.
Yep.
Not a thorough lecture. A long just lecture.
Well, actually, no.
It's all about Star Wars.
Because it's all about Star Wars.
It's all about Star Wars, so I love it.
I take Luke Skywalker and we take him through the hero's journey.
Yep.
He has a Luke Skywalker action.
Here's the thing that I find really interesting, and I kind of hinted about it earlier, but Lawrence of Arabia is kind of like this, if not the first, then kind of this like basic example of the that story in which a guy from a different culture comes in, becomes the greatest warrior of that culture, and then helps them to surmount their, you know, problems, right?
Yeah. But then ultimately becomes their enemy.
I don't think he did here.
I think that there are a lot of people lost faith in him.
And that's fine. This movie kind of has a downer ending because it's kind of realistic. But what I'm saying is that basic idea that we see in The Last Samurai, that we see in Avatar, that we see in all of these movies.
Dances with Wolves,
certainly. Originates here. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't originate here, then it definitely gets codified as viable movie material.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, like, I always make the joke that I've seen Dances with Wolves 1,000 times because I've seen it as 1,000 different movies.
Right.
But really,
most of them with Kevin Costner.
Yeah. But really, what I should have been saying is I've seen Lawrence of Arabia 1,000 times because that obviously predates Dances with Wolves.
I would say don't let the length of this movie deter you from watching it if you're listening at home. Because when you see 222 minutes, you're like, holy crap, this is a 4 or 5, 10-hour movie.
Math divide by 60.
Yeah.
It's 3 hours.
Yeah, 3.5 hours. I mean, it's a long movie. But even the shots of these big, long, you know, 5-minute, 10-minute sequences of them walking across the desert have a real point to the story, right? You have to show how burning hot they are, how they have no water, how people are.
How difficult everything is.
Yeah, so that when Lawrence gets to the edge of the desert and he turns around and says, where's Gimshi or whatever the guy's name is? Oh, no, he fell back behind a long ways. You can't go back for him. Oh, I'm going back for him.
Watch me.
Watch me do this. That has a whole point. While you just watch them struggle through the desert for 15 minutes.
Right.
Then he goes and rescues the friend, this person that he cares for, brings him back. Everybody cheers him. And then he has to end up killing this guy, shooting him in the face.
Right.
And then that becomes the tragedy. Here I almost died myself trying to save this person, and then ultimately I have to kill him. So these really long sequences. And there's some great battle sequences, too, like the blowing up of the train is just awesome to see in this aspect ratio. But they all have a point to further the story. And I don't, and I believe that David Lean would have cut out things that he thought were unnecessary if he felt it was making the film too long.
Too long.
Yeah.
I agree. It was... So, yeah, I was terrified to watch this movie. I planned to watch it multiple sessions, which I ended up doing. But it's not a movie that's just long, really, for... I don't think it's like a movie that's long for long's sake. It's not trying to hit a huge
It's not the problem that we were talking about.
Not,
and also in another... And, listeners, if you're a fan of this podcast, you really should listen to Top 5, number, I want to say, 51, 52, where we all discuss our top 5...
Things in movies that we want to see go away.
Film techniques that we want to see go away. And I'm not going to say whose it is, but the long movie, just for long movie sakes, as Zach's referring to, is one of those things that's gotten out of control.
Lawrence of Arabia is the longest movie I've ever watched, but it doesn't feel like the longest movie I've ever watched. It's certainly more attention-grabbing and forward-moving than some movies that I've watched that are even two and a half hours long or two hours long.
Wait until you get to the 12-hour Birth of a Nation that we'll be watching.
Good Lord.
Yeah, I'm sick that day.
Whatever day it is.
So
yes, I have a previous engagement that I need to make as soon as possible.
It's interesting, the directors who have gone on record to say that this movie has influenced them, that the visual style has influenced them. George Lucas watched Star Wars.
Clearly.
Clearly. Sam Peckinpah, Martin Scorsese, Ridley Scott.
Scorsese, you can totally see it.
Steven Spielberg, all been influenced by this. And I forget which one called the film a miracle. But it's influenced by these directors. And interestingly, they would have been, gosh, somebody look up real quick. Matthew, do your internet magics. Tell me how old Steven Spielberg was in 62.
Internet magic. How old is Steven Spielberg?
Scorsese would have been 20.
Steven Spielberg is 66 years old.
He was born in 1946, so in 60 what?
Two.
He would have been 16 years old.
So we did another show back before this was Zach on Film, where we discussed...
That was my internet magic, by the way. Did you like that?
Where we discussed...
Good work, Siri.
Yeah, good work, Siri.
I don't have a Siri. How dare you!
Where we discuss this magical age where things coalesce with you. And so it's interesting that we're seeing between the ages of 16 and 20, suddenly this movie comes out.
Yeah.
And these guys are like, oh, this is it. And that could have been one of these driving factors to put them where they're at. So, Zach, another question for you.
Yeah.
What visual style or technique in this film has inspired you going forward?
Oh, that's a good question. I really like the
one that he asks you every week.
I know. It's just sometimes.
Well, this week I phrased it a little differently.
Yeah. I liked
the shots
of pushing in to a face that ended up being like super like tight up in the frame.
Oh, yeah. And can you imagine seeing that? And that ultra wide screen. I mean, that's why I say you see
just one of Peter O'Toole's glorious blue eyes.
Yes. I mean,
it's the size of an ocean.
This man is good looking in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
he's a beautiful man.
He is really beautiful.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be honest, this is his really first major acting gig. He played like Trooper 1 and Trooper 2 and a couple other movies and had a TV series.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as his big movie breakout role, this is it.
Well, and the crazy thing about it is that this character is so specific and so particular. It's like, it's very feminine, very frail.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And also crazy.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's crazy to start out your career as that character. And it's amazing that he was ever able to break away from that. And he did. I mean, you see, you know, his career, and he plays always very, you know, insanely British characters. Yeah, yeah. But
can you imagine this film with Albert Finney or Anthony Perkins or Marlon Brando?
Marlon Brando was maybe not. This. But, you know, maybe he could pull it off.
Alec Guinness had already played Lawrence already in a play, so he was a contender too.
They're like, no, Alec, you look kind of Arabic, I think.
Yeah. You have that sort of Welsh Arabic thing going on.
And
that's totally a thing.
Lawrence Olivier was originally going to play Prince Faisal, or Faisal.
Prince Ali.
Fazul. Yeah.
As strong as 10 regular men. I don't know words.
So anyway, sorry, back to your magnificent close-ups of Peter O'Toole.
Yeah, I really like that film technique.
That's my band name, by the way.
Peter O'Toole. Yeah, that's good.
Like Peter O'Toole and the magnificent close-ups?
Yes.
Magnificent close-ups of Peter O'Toole.
Them and Devil
Elevator. Devil Elevator, secretly a ghost.
Yeah.
Secretly the future.
Yeah, secretly the future. All ghost all along, yeah.
Ghost all along.
Again, you need to listen to Stump 5.
Somebody, we're referencing the future.
Stop it. You're ruining the jokes before people get there.
Yeah, that sucks.
Right.
Trust
that
me,
out.
It's more brilliant.
Yeah,
no, totally.
You know, just be like me. You'll forget by the time you hear the episode.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, anything else visually that you're bringing from?
Visually? No.
That's it?
I really like those shots. I really like the pushing.
Notice how they shoot the sand, right? Notice how they shoot these desert scenes. They, at one point, will show the desert in glorious... I mean, it's the same, almost the same time of day when they're shooting a lot of this. The time of the day where you don't want to be shooting sand.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But at some points, the desert is beautiful and golden, and the sky is this magnificent blue. And then when bad stuff is happening, that same sand looks brazen and harsh, mm-hmm, and doesn't look warm and inviting, and the sky is kind of a muddy gray color. Mm-hmm. Even though it's still blue, you can still tell that it's, you know, they're bringing you into the story in these wide vistas to really tell you what's going on in this environment and how it's affecting these people. If you look at the composition and how, and this is really something you need to work on, is creating depth in your space. Because even though we're looking at a very wide scene, wider than what our eye would normally see just looking at stuff, in the foreground you have a little mountain, what are those, mesa, right? You've got a little mesa in the foreground, and then way off in the mid-ground you see the camels and the riders going across the desert. And then far in the background you see the dunes with the wind blowing across it. And so that depth helps you get drawn into the story as well. So look at how you really compose this shot. And Lean is a brilliant director. I forget who the cinematographer is on this. This is F.A. Young, who did the cinematography on here. Just brilliant in how he's taking this harsh landscape and using it as a real character in this story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's wonderful, Zach. So go back and just compare the scene where he's going back to save the boy. The boy,
mm-hmm,
right? And then compare that to the scene where they're blowing up the train.
Okay.
Same desert, different same style camp of bringing the world to life and having that interact. It's really cool.
One technique that I don't want to carry forward that I was noticed it much more than I have in previous films is Day for Night,
which is
all up in this film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like anything in the desert at night. Well, it's super day.
Yeah.
I mean, then what I thought about is like, the only way you can pull the night shots off is if huge generators you're lugging out into the desert.
Right.
You don't
Or if you do it in a soundstage.
Soundstage, I guess. Okay,
day for night was the thing that they did in the 60s, though, that nobody knew sucked yet.
Yes.
Yeah, it sucked.
Shot on location in Tunisia and Burbank.
So check this out. So they did all this pre-production starting in, I don't know when.
15, 17.
But the film began shooting on May 15th, 1961, wrapped shooting on October 20th of 1962. The movie hit theaters in December of 62.
That's like an 18-month shooting schedule.
They had an 18-month shooting schedule, and then they had less than 2 months to get this out into the theaters.
Insane.
No wonder it's 250 minutes long. They didn't actually edit it. They just taped the rushes together.
There are some, and listeners, if you go over to majorspoilers.com, our parent site, and you click on that Amazon link, you can go over and you can get Lawrence of Arabia and Blu-ray. That's the one that I would recommend. But there are also, Zach, some really good biographies on
T.E. Lawrence.
On David Lean.
Oh, David Lean.
The director. And let me see if I can find the one that I'm looking for. There's David Lean, a biography, and there's another one with him just kind of looking out at the leaning the reader from things. Yeah, leaning on things and looking at you. You know the one I'm talking about.
It's
the
David picture that Lean.
It's the picture that everybody knows of David
this
Lean.
Is my cousin Jack Swagger.
But you should go and pick up a biography because it's fascinating to read about and learn about how he approaches film, because there is no way today that you would be able to take a movie as long as this and get it done in under 2 months.
No.
So
there's
he's
no way you could get it in the theater.
He's directing, he's shooting, he's also making sure that it's being edited while he's still shooting.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that sometimes happens today. But most of the time, the conventional is for every week shooting, you get 2.5 weeks of post-production. So if you're shooting for 90 days, you basically have a little over 180 days, 200 days to edit it. And then you get it released. So if you look at, you know, the Avengers 2 wrapping up production next week or whatever it is, in 180 days plus promotional time, it'll be in the theaters. Not so with this movie, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, that's insane.
Fascinating. Final question. Your girlfriend watched this movie with you?
No. She was in the room doing homework chunk of it.
Did she not see this movie and go, who is this beautiful man?
No, she's just looking at me.
Bam. Oh. Bam. No, you should say, while she was saying it, she was looking
likely.
At me.
Yeah, I got to tell you.
Sir, I've seen Peter O'Toole as Lawrence of Arabia, and sir, are
no
Peter
I am no
O'Toole.
Peter O'Toole.
You're
You've
a tool.
Kind of a Gavin Rossdale sort of thing going for you. Maybe like a Billy Corgan with hair thing, but you are no Peter O'Toole.
Final thoughts about Zach's analysis and reflections on this movie?
I think it did well. I think that possibly this time it actually paid off that he saw it in chunks so that his attention span could actually get everything in that he needed to. Had some good insight and managed to not stall for too long at your question. So I think he passes this time around.
What about you, Matthew?
I agree. I think the big expectation I have when it comes to this is what I like to call the Tommy Boaz factor, which is, does he sound like he's bluffing? And it's clear that Zach actually watched the majority of the 397 minutes of Lawrence of Arabia. That right there is the basis. That's a C+ for me. Getting through this material is a passing grade. I'm going to go with a high B. I'm going to go B+ for the whole thing. He's definitely got some insights. He had some thoughts that I never considered about Lawrence of Arabia. And, you know, it's definitely... He needs to maybe prepare for that question that you ask him every single week. But, you know, that's more of a side issue.
The fact that I ask him the same question every week and he still doesn't
have an answer. You ask him, Zach, I'm Steven, Zach. Let me ask you something. What techniques did you see in this film?
Well, that's what he's supposed to be doing, right?
And that's the thing, exactly. You ask him that every week for 97 weeks now. And every week he's kind of like, oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking about candy bracelets.
But actually, again, they're candy necklaces. Let's get it right.
Yeah, please. Please know my thoughts better.
I'm old and out of touch. I'm going to be 43 soon.
Yes,
you know, when you're 43, your life is over.
I'll be 23 next year. Scython.
All right, Zach, get us out of here.
I will come to your house and slap you.
That'll be it for Zach on Film this week. Make sure to head over to majorspoilers.com and find the podcast posting page. That's three P words in a row.
It's called alliteration.
Mm-hmm. English is fun. And click on the Amazon.com link while you're there and do your shopping of Peter O'Toole posters and pinups and buy Lawrence of Arabia on Blu-ray and remastered and pick up some biographies and stuff.
Page, you get Peter's pinups.
Yeah. So a little won't cost you any extra to buy all that goodies, but a little bit will come back to us to keep this ship afloat. That'll be it for this week. Next week, we are finding some apes on a planet in Planet of the Apes. Next week on Zach on Film.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.